chances are you're pretty familiar with this guy's voice. Abnan Al-Haradi is a well-known radio show host and stand-up comedian. And during this conversation, we talk a lot about how he found his way towards becoming a comedian and also worked towards accomplishing his childhood dream of becoming a radio show host. We dive into some of the lessons he learned along the way, some of the difficulties and struggles, his creative process behind writing jokes, and sort of the science or art behind making things funny, and so many things in between. If you like what you're about to listen to, don't forget to share it with your friends and give us a rating wherever you're listening to this podcast from. Enjoy. Faye, it's good about levels.
Oh, is it recording?
We're getting right into it.
Getting right into it. That's the introduction. Okay. So, so the question was before we hit the record button about us wearing headphones and in the radio studio. Yeah, we wear headphones. You know, we need to hear our levels. For example, we're doing it right now. So, if I know that I need to be louder, I'll just get closer to the mic like this.
Right.
But you've got a really good mic, so.
It's a good setup. It's super basic.
No, it's good. It's good. It's on a bunch of books, though. I don't know why.
Because apparently it records, the audio quality improves when it's...
When it's leveled up. Oh, okay.
Any level to your...
Okay. So, Fahed Lakhslebi, thank you for having me here, man.
Max, such a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, so, I think we've been trying to do this for how long now?
I've been chasing you for a year.
I mean, if I'm not mistaken, it's probably more than a year. I'll just have to go through my messages and then figure it out. But if I was to guess, it was pre-COVID times, so that was at least a year and a half. Definitely.
A lot.
Well, I made it.
You made it.
I made it. A lot has changed. Yes. Yes, it is.
I was surprised how busy you are.
Busy is a blessing. Hmm. I've identified a few opportunities that I liked, and I was blessed to be given the opportunities I have, and I took it. And, during COVID times, I believe there were two extremes. One was where somebody just, you know, everything stopped for them, and others just got super busy. And I believe there are pros and cons to both, you know. Busy is good. It's tiring. Mm. But the one thing that I tell every busy person or someone who's going to become very, very busy is you got to take care of your health. Mm. Like, I've been on a diet since I was 7, you know, and I have let work, or my career get in between me and my health so many times. But then what happens is during the year, 3 months, I'm doing great. I'm eating clean. I'm exercising. I drop the weight, you know, I'm gaining muscle. And then 9 months out of that year, I'm just random, and then everything I've done for the past 3 months just goes down the drain. So basically, I'm pregnant. That's how I feel. When you're a really, really busy man, so anyone listening to this, if you guys are really, really busy, if you guys are gonna get busy, even if you're not busy, health is wealth. That's the one thing I've learned.
Tarif, I couldn't agree with you more. I think... as the saying goes, a healthy person has 1,000 problems, but a sick person has one problem. And all they want to do is get better.
And I'm going to share.
I really think it's the most valuable thing.
It is. And it's unfortunate because sometimes you only realize how important your health is when you start losing it.
Absolutely.
I'm going to share something with you that happened to me in November.
Was this last year? Shoulder?
Oh my God! Did we chat when that was happening?
I heard some rumors.
Oh, it was. Let me tell you the story. So, I've had a shoulder issue since high school. I've got a condition called hypermobile, which means my joints are not as stable as they're supposed to be. I'm talking about my shoulders, my knees. So if I'm not careful, if I don't have a good amount of muscle supporting me, stuff can pop out. So I did well during the years. And, you know, this problem of my shoulder getting dislocated was almost forgotten and I was good. Until one Tuesday morning, I woke up like any other morning. The alarm woke me up. Now, keep in mind, I have just woken up. The alarms, you know, an alarm just wakes you up and you're like, oh God, here we go. So I turned to my right to turn off the alarm. And just in the process of returning back to my original position, my right shoulder just pops out.
Oh my God.
And imagine that kind of shock when you just wake up. Like I already struggle to sleep. So imagine waking up, you know, tired, and then your shoulder pops out. Now,
what a way to start the day.
By the way, it gets better. It gets better. So I actually have a technique to relocate my shoulder. Okay.
Oh, and this is something you learned over the years.
It's something I learned over the years. Okay. And, you know, when I go to the physiotherapists and I discuss it with them, they're like, yes, that's a good technique. But when you're in so much pain, it's difficult to focus, you know? So when it popped out and I realized that it's not in its place, I sat up and then I immediately started focusing on bringing it back in. Now, I could not express myself. So when something hits you, when you get hurt, what do you say? You say, ow, you say, ouch. You start expressing yourself. I couldn't because my mom's in the living room and I did not want her to hear me struggle. Because if the poor woman opens the door and sees my shoulder in an awkward position and I'm trying to relocate it, her anxiety is going
to
kick
in.
So I'm focusing on my breathing and I realize my technique is not working. So what did I do? I leaned forward, dropped my shoulder forward, dropped my arm. I let the whole thing slip out. And then I started looking for that slot to bring it back in while being careful that I don't tear anything. So that went on for some time. We're talking about the longest 3 minutes of my life. Okay? And then success. Boom.
Snap back in.
And I was just trying to get over that I just went through this. So I felt my temperature dropping. I felt like my face started feeling funny. I just thought I needed to wash my face and hydrate. So we're recording, so I'm going to watch my language. Being the genius I am, I went to the bathroom to wash my face.
Yeah.
Now, I do remember washing my face, okay. But the next thing you know, I'm waking up on the bathroom floor and I'm confused. I'm like, why am I on the floor? I should be in bed. And then I felt this sharp pain on the side of my head. And then it immediately hit me. I fainted because of the shock. And in the process of falling, my head hit an elevated tile.
Oh my God.
And it cut open. So there's this blood around me and my head hurts. And I immediately realized what happened. I'm like, okay, I passed out. I cut my head open and I need to deal with this now. Keep in mind, it's not even 7 a.m. Okay.
I'm in shock.
But there's the reason why I'm sharing all of this is there's a point I'm going to make after this. So I put myself together, washed the blood up, didn't want my mom to know, and just drove myself to the hospital. Now, before driving to the hospital, I called my physiotherapist, and he knows me very well. Bless him, Iyad Farid. He's been taking care of me for years. And I called him, and I'm pretty sure that when he saw my name on his phone at 7 a.m., he'd be like, oh, no, here we go. So I called him. I said, Iyad, this happened. I've cut my head open. I need to stitch myself up. Where do I go? And he gave me options. And he's like, are you by yourself? Are you driving alone? I'm like, yeah. He's like, hydrate, remain calm, and then just take care of it. Went to the hospital. Now, while I'm on the hospital bed, okay, and I didn't realize how bad the cut was until the nurse asked me to stand up so she can weigh me. And I'm like, listen, I don't want to be moving around. I just want to be stitched up and I want to go home. Okay. And she's like, what happened? And I just turned my head to the side to show her. Keep in mind, I couldn't see the cut. And this poor nurse just started panicking. She's like, oh my God. And I'm like, oh, it's a bad cut. It's a bad cut. And the point, now I'm going to get to that. Now that was the unpleasant experience I went through. Okay.
Yeah.
But the point is, when I was on that, when I was on that hospital bed waiting to get stitched up, I'd finished the x-rays and the scans. And doctor came in and he's like, how are we feeling? And I'm like, it's a great way to start the morning, but I'm okay. I survived. And then he's like, oh, I'm really sorry about what you went through, but don't worry, we're going to take care of it. And I said, you know what? I'm grateful. And it was very true. I was very grateful.
Wow.
And he said, oh, explain. And I said, I'm grateful that worst case scenario is a bunch of stitches.
Wow.
And I'm going to be back on track. But I did not, of course, I realized the next day that the fall, I had really bad head pain, my neck, my ribs, because I'm a heavy guy. I don't know if you've noticed.
The impact,
I just fainted flat on a bathroom floor. So I was very grateful that, to me, at that moment, it was just a matter of, it was six stitches. Anesthetic did not work, and I have a habit of laughing when I'm in pain. So poor doctor is trying to stitch my head up, and I'm just laughing to the point where another doctor came in, and he's like, "What's going on? Is there a comedy show?" And then the doctor actually said it. He's like, "Funny you say that. This guy is a comedian." So I was grateful that it was just six stitches, but then what happened the next 10 days? Really made me rethink life in general. I'll tell you why. When I was on the bed, I messaged the chairman of our company, a company that I manage, and I said, hey, I'm going to be missing in action for a while. I won't be reachable. I need to take care of something that just happened. So I'm really sorry, but I'll be back as soon as I can. And he was very understanding. He's like, hey, listen, you just take care of your health. And we'll deal with all our tasks when you're back. I was out for 10 days because the next day, what happened to me is that my immune system crashed because of what I went through. And my sinuses kicked in and I felt really sick. Now, the good news is this happened on a Tuesday. I was already scheduled for a PCR COVID test on a Wednesday morning. Wow. So I showed up to the PCR test. I've got a sling. My head looks like I'm wearing a turban. And the nurse is like, I can't help but to ask, were you in an accident? I'm like, no, actually, I was asleep. And then blah, blah, blah. So when I fell sick on that Thursday, I was glad that I took the test. It was negative. Otherwise, that would have really messed with my head because my sinuses kicked in. My throat started to block up. And I felt terribly sick. So my physiotherapist told me, he's like, Amran, your immune system has crashed and you are going to need to deal with it now. And in those 10 days, I couldn't move around. My head really hurt. Like, oh my God, those stitches, it's the most annoying thing. Because when you have stitches on your head,
yes.
you can't put a Band-Aid on it. Because you've got hair and it doesn't stick.
Right.
So I had to use this spray that creates a layer over the skin, but it mixes with the hair. And it's so uncomfortable and annoying. And I shave my head. I like it shaved. So when it starts growing, it looks like a kiwi that you dipped in the water. So for 10 days, I didn't shave my head and I was uncomfortable. And so the point is, in those 10 days, I was really rethinking my life. I'm like, listen, I work too much. I should create a balance. I should start eating or avoid eating foods that are killing me slowly. Now I'm finally back on track. I exercise minimum 3 times a week. I've been watching my food like I'm going to enter a bikini contest.
What a shock to the system.
Exactly. It was, It was not a pleasant experience. I got to fix a shoulder now. There are two solutions. Either I increase the muscle, or the muscle mass, I mean, or I do the surgery. But even if I do take the surgery or go for the surgery, I got to strengthen the shoulder because the rehab is going to be really difficult if I don't.
Right.
So, yeah.
Wow. And I know from following your journey, you've had like lots of ups and downs. Like your going for the Ironman.
Oh, yeah.
And then
that was, I still can't believe I did the Ironman 70.3. But the way I like to say it, I am a finisher. That was a good experience. But I'd like to call it that I survived Ironman.
You're a survivor.
I'm a survivor. That's a whole different story. So, lots of ups and downs. And again, if you can find a way to find a balance and avoid that yo-yo or right. that zigzag, whatever you want to call it, that's the way to go.
Right. I think,
you know, we're human beings.
And if you go all in and you're so committed towards a goal, it's easy to, you know, as soon as that's accomplished, poof, swing back. All that momentum pulls you back the other way.
It's going to pull you back. Yeah. And one other thing, like I said, my training is like pregnancy. 3 months, I'm doing great. 9 months, I'm gaining weight. So now what I'm doing, and I strongly believe this, if you want to focus not just on one goal, on multiple goals, you got to disappear for a while. Mm. Okay. I have a lot of friends who are upset with me, but luckily I do have a lot of friends who understand. Mm. So when I wake up at stupid o'clock in the morning, I have a morning routine, and then I go to work and I spend a lot of time there. And then I got a few things on the side as well, but not as much as before. We'll get to that. That's a whole different topic. You end up valuing time. You end up looking at time in a very different way. And there's something that I've learned in the recent years. I call it Team Imran. And I'd call that Team Fed for you.
Okay, tell me more.
So, exactly. So I was waiting for you to say that because when someone says, what do you mean Team Imran? What do you mean Team Fahd? What do you mean Team whoever? Now, Team Fahd are a group of people who are out there for your best and look out for your best interest. Mm-hmm. They play an important role, whether it's small or big, mm-hmm. in your success and your growth and your well-being. Mm. Anything that's related to you becoming a better version of yourself, they play a role in it. Mm. Once you identify Team Fahd, you look at life very differently. Because you got to be careful of who walks in pretending to be a team member. Mm. You know, you got to learn how to identify these people. So when you have Team Fahd, whenever you need to lean back on someone, whenever you need downtime, whenever you need support, help, whenever you want to share any of your successes, and I know you've been doing very well in the motorsport industry, if I'm not mistaken. So the ones who clap when you're standing on that podium, the ones who will ask you if you need a ride, the ones will ask you if, do you need me to do anything? Is there anything I can do? Those are Team Fahd. So I learned about the concept of Team Imran in the recent years. And that completely changed it for me. So when I need to disappear, and when I say disappear, I don't mean going under a tunnel. I mean just being very focused on what you're doing and spending time with people who add value to your life. Now, the biggest misunderstanding, or a lot of people misunderstand me where they say, oh, but you're neglecting people. You shouldn't be. I'm like, I'm not neglecting people. Okay. I meet random people for coffee once in a while. I'm here with you and I think this is a great experience. So a lot of people misunderstand, you know, we're not, blocking people.
Right.
We just have a different focus, you know? So when we get that busy, there's always someone who can pick you up when your car breaks down. Mm-hmm. There's always someone who will, you know, take you to the hospital when you need it. Mm-hmm. There's always someone who will, I don't know, if you've got a race and there needs to be a team there to take care of a few things, that's Team Fed. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I've never really done any motorsports racing. The most I've done was I test drove a Bentley at the BIC.
Oh, nice.
And it was a V12 Bentley, and everybody was driving like there's no tomorrow, and I was cruising. That's my motorsports experience. And when they asked me, why are you driving so slow? And I'm like, where am I going to go? I'm going in circles. I just want to enjoy the car. Anyway, that's me sidetracking. So, when you go to bed tonight, think about it. Who's Team Fed? Mm. You know, write it down. I see you're a guy about notes. You're taking notes and write it down. Team Fed, you know, give them their roles, you know. And
I love that. See, I guess that really shapes. It's very easy to sort of, in life, just go with the flow, go with momentum. Certain people end up around you. And they can, whether you like it or not, the people who you spend time with are people who are going to shape your life.
Yes.
They're going to have a huge influence on you. So
absolutely.
I love this way of seeing things, because I think you're basically putting control back with you. You're not letting
absolutely
your environment take over your identity, who you are, what you want to be. You're putting yourself back in the driving seat by being in charge of Team Abraham.
Yes. And the way of another way of looking at it is you don't let the atmosphere own you. You own it. Mm. Owning something is a very, I look at some, like when someone tells me, I got a flat tire today and it ruined my entire day. And I say, okay, are you going to let that flat tire own you?
Yeah.
Or are you going to own the situation? And they're like, how am I going to own the situation? And I'm like, tell me about your experience. Oh, I had to, figure out a tow truck. And then we went somewhere. And then I had to figure out which tire I needed. And I'm like, there you go. You're more experienced than you were yesterday. Mm. Now you've got this tow truck guy saved on your phone. Whenever you need it the next time, you don't have to figure it out. You're just going to dial it. So you need a new tire. You know which size you need. So own the situation.
That's beautiful.
The simplest example, I'll tell you how I own the traffic when I'm stuck in it.
Okay.
When I'm stuck in traffic, it's very interesting. And I told you that recent years I learned all of this. When you're stuck in traffic, what happens? You get frustrated.
Yeah.
People honking.
People cutting you off.
People cutting you off.
You're late and everyone's
so you get, just... you, what do you get? You get frustrated. That's the normal thing.
Yeah.
What I do is I turn on an audiobook. And I start listening, because to me, like, if I can gain knowledge in those 45 minutes that I'm stuck, I'm going to own that traffic.
Amazing.
Bring it on.
Amazing.
So, yeah, when I'm stuck in those 45 minutes, I've got multiple apps that I use. Mm. Some are paid, some are free. So there's so much content out there. And I'm just listening to audiobooks. I'm boring. I mostly read about self-development. All these authors that I like, so I just turn my phone on and I listen.
That's amazing.
And the next thing you know, these 45 minutes of traffic that I've been in actually did me good.
Yeah. It sounds like what you're talking about is, whether you want to have a victim mentality, you can be a victim of any situation,
yes,
or you can take advantage of that situation.
Or you can turn it around for yourself.
Right.
And I can give you 50 examples about turning around a negative situation to a positive. Mm. Do you know, when I was in my early 20s, nobody wanted to hire me.
Okay.
Nobody wanted to hire me, to the point where...
And you're as a fresh grad, Danny?
Fresh grad, you name it. Like, even during college... Mm. All my friends got all these cool internships, and I wanted one. Mm. And I would actually knock on the doors of all these companies. I would show up with my terrible resume that I worked so hard on. And I was not getting employed. And even in my mid-20s, I was looking for employment, and I couldn't find it. So what did I do? I created opportunities for myself.
How did you do that?
Simple. I started organizing my own events, putting together my own projects, and on my resume, instead of experience, I called it achievements. So one achievement, for example, I started hosting these open mic nights. Now, when you put it on paper, it makes more sense calling it an achievement because there's stats, you know, organized X amount of open mic nights, creating or increasing the local talent pool in Bahrain, and then that resulting in different multiple revenue streams of A, B, C, D. So it looks interesting on your resume, but basically what I was doing is, okay, I'm going to find a venue that's not doing very well. Mm-hmm. I'm going to cut a deal with them that you give me your stage, sound, and lights, and I am going to bring the people. And over there, we have a business arrangement. And I did that consistently for some time.
Was this when you started exploring comedy?
Yeah, that's what I'm doing is I'm jumping timelines.
Henner.
So when I started comedy, it was 2008. I was working as an ICT consultant, believe it or not. Even sometimes I forget. And I got the opportunity to be the host for the Axis of Evil comedy tour in Bahrain. So they were coming to the Maz Jibrani, Ahmed Ahmed.
Well, how do you make that leap to becoming the host?
How do you?
I'm sure you built a foundation before.
I'll tell you where it came from. Now, my mistake right now is I'm jumping timelines. So whoever is going to be listening to this, they'll be like, wait a minute, early 20s, but now you're IT consultant, like what? Or ICT consultant, like what happened?
We'll try to keep up with you.
So I'm going to take a few steps back here because we're just freestyling this, right? When I was 19...
Okay.
19. I'm in college. Mm-hmm. I'm living life. Mm-hmm. And a friend of mine, his dad had a sound and lights company. Mm-hmm. Okay. And we used to help him install the sound equipment. And in return, we got to just hang out. And to us, that was a huge reward because it's a free party. We're chilling. Awesome atmosphere. And I used to help the DJs that would come in. That's how I learned about music and I learned how to play.
Interesting.
Until one day, there was an outdoor event where we showed up to help. And then we're like, oh, okay, we'll see you later. And then turns out that event, the MC went missing. They were panicking. The guys, he wasn't answering his phone. The event started. Damn. So my friend's dad said, hey, you're shameless. Come here. And I said, son, can you just make a few announcements on the mic? Let's just support this company. And I said, sure. Give me that paper. And
you literally just got thrown into it.
Yeah. I grabbed that paper and it was very simple. It was just a few announcements it was a motorsports. It was a car display.
Okay.
By the way, this was early 2000s. Okay, so motorsport back then was very different. We were still...
The
racetrack, yeah. Exactly. And so what we had back then were car shows. Mm-hmm. You'd go to a car show and you see all these different cars from collectors. That's what it was. And of course, then the track in 2004 mm-hmm. happened and that changed mm-hmm. the game completely. But that's a different topic. So... I started making these announcements, and the next thing you know, I started talking to the drivers. The drivers were German. They didn't speak English, so they had a translator. So I'm talking to the translator. The translator's talking to the drivers, and then it was this three-way communication. And then I started to have fun with it. I started to crack jokes. I'm asking the drivers, and there were Ferraris there. I'm like, can I drive your Ferrari? And they're like, no. And I'm like, I don't have a driver's license, but I promise I won't leave the parking lot. And they're like, no, who is this guy? So that's how I grabbed the mic.
Interesting.
And sometime after that, companies started to call me and ask me if I want, you know, they're like, how much would you charge? We want you to do that for our company. And I'm like, you want to pay me?
Wow.
I'm like, that's crazy. You know this. And there was this time right after that where I started teaching martial arts.
I was one of your students.
And you were one of my students. So, you know, on that note, a very big shout out to your uncle, your uncle Sahel Xaibi. He had Zendo and I was a member, and he offered me a part-time thing where I would teach per hour. And then that turned into an actual job. And I remember at that time, life was so interesting. So I think my busy schedule started there because I was studying. I was doing full-time study, and then I would leave class, and then I would go to the dojo, and then I'd be there at 3:30. I'd stay there till 10. Wow. And then at one point, I was doing technical support for an architectural company. I didn't have to be there. They just called me and said, hey, this and this is not working. And I'd guide them through the phone because, you know, I had set hours in class. I had set hours teaching at Zendo. So I'm like, hey, listen, I can guide you through the phone. I mean, they paid me close to nothing, but it was a lot for me back then. And then what I would do on the weekends, they gave me the key to the office. And I would go on the weekends and I just maintain their computers. I'd make sure all the printers are connected to the network. And I did that over the weekend.
What a lifestyle.
And next thing you know, I started DJing for weddings. I was a wedding DJ at one point.
No way.
Yeah. I started DJing for weddings actively 2004, 2005. And that was a tough one. Being a wedding DJ is not easy.
What's it like?
It's, you deal with all kinds of people.
Yeah, I'm sure that part, like the organization.
It's tough because I remember I DJed a wedding for a British family. It was a lot of fun. But the bride kept asking me to play Rihanna's Don't Stop the Music over and over and over again. And keep in mind, when I would play the track for the second or third time, her guests are giving me the evil eye. Like, what kind of stupid DJ is this? Playing the same song over and over again. And then her husband came up to me and he's like, hey, listen, I'm really sorry, but she wants the song again. Oh my God. So at that time...
this puts you in a very awkward
position. Yeah, but you know what I did, right? I grabbed the mic... And I started kind of working the dance floor and talking to them. And they're all like, yeah, we're partying. And I'm like, listen, it's the bride's night tonight. The bride wants to hear Rihanna, Don't Stop the Music. And we're going to play it over and over again. Are you guys down? And they all went, yeah. So, nice. So you know, you can take that.
Spin it around.
You can spin it around. But then I've had some difficult. I had this one wedding, this random guy came up to me and he's like, play Rashid al-Majid track number 7. And I'm like, I'm sorry, I don't know what track number 7 is. He's like, track number 7 from I don't know which album. And I was like, well, I'm playing Pitbull right now. There are 400 people dancing on the dance floor and you want me to play track number 7 from Rashid al-Majid. So that was tough, dealing with that. And there were misunderstandings. I got hired once to DJ for this really fancy party, and I didn't know this, but when I got there, it was a ladies only thing. So they kind of put me in a tent where I can't see the dance floor. And
wow, yeah, strange.
So I got there and I'm like, so where's the DJ booth? And they're like, oh, it's behind that tent. So you got to get in there before the guests show up. And I'm like, excuse me? And then the lady's like, yeah, this is a ladies only party. You can't be out and about. I'm like, how am I going to read the dance floor? How do I know they're dancing? So I'm like, sure. I went and I sat in this tent where I couldn't see anything. And then the biggest misunderstanding was they wanted someone to play Arabic the whole time. And I only played English. So I spoke to the lady. I said, listen, I'm happy to return your money, but I think there's been a misunderstanding because I was recruited through someone who I think didn't.
Like,
so this is what I used to go through. And then she's like, oh, well, you know, it's okay. I'm not going to ask for the money back, but what do we do? And I said, and this is how long ago this was. And I'm like, do you have an iPod? And she's like, yeah, I do. Can I hook it up? I'm like, please. So she got me her iPod and I told her to just cue the songs you like that you guys want to dance to. And I'm just going to chill here behind this tent until you guys are done. And so imagine that's the kind of stuff I went through as a DJ.
Fascinating.
Yeah. So life, and then I just got busier and busier. But I think, and now we're going to get to the point where how it all started. Yeah,
the link
that was just a taste of what I did in the past. And funny thing is, a lot of people don't know this. I started off as a musician more than an actual radio host or a comedian. And my first love was the guitar. Yeah. I used to play for bands. I used to sing. That was late 90s, early 2000s.
I had no idea.
Jam at University of Bahrain, these carnivals, these events.
I had no idea.
That's a very interesting part of my past. I still play, but I play for my toilet walls. Like, you know, not that I play in the bathroom, but I play for myself now. That was my first love. Music was my first love. I remember in high school, whenever they needed someone to arrange the sound, they just brought me along. I'm like, why are you bringing me along? They just assumed I knew how to do it because I played the electric guitar, because I plugged the guitar in an amp. I'm like, but that's a complete different thing than a whole PA system, dude. But you know what, though? I learned. I figured it out. So, 2000, 2001, I was in college. Actually, no. Forget college. I was grade 3. I was in the car with my mom. She was dropping me to school. And I was listening to Radio Bahrain. And I was just so fascinated by Radio Bahrain. I used to listen to it like it was my job. Well, it is now. But and I used to listen to the radio hosts. And I used to tell my mom, Mom, this is what I want to do when I grow up. I was in grade 3 or grade 4. That's how far the memory goes. Then we reach high school after I graduated from high school. It was 1999 and I was, you know, thinking about where I want to study, what I want to do. And then I'd listen to the radio and I'm like, I can do this. And I started applying to the radio station from the year 2000.
Wow.
At least 3 times a year. This is where we go back to the point where I felt like nobody wanted to hire me. And I started applying blindly. I would go drop my resume at the security gate and say, this, can you pass this on to the radio? And then I would meet some of the radio hosts randomly and I'd be like, hey, can you pass on my demo? And I did that consistently for 6 years.
Wow.
6 years.
Was basically like a
recording of
what you would do
as if I'm on the radio.
Okay.
And because I used to record music, it wasn't difficult for me to record audio as if I'm live on air. 2006. I remember I was working for a telecom company as an entry-level job. And I heard this ad on the radio. And the ad was, do you think you can do better? Well, guess what? Join Radio Bahrain. Radio Bahrain are looking to increase their team of DJs. Prepare your resume and a demo of you speaking as if you're on the radio. And drop it to P.O. Box, blah, 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 blah. Or Ministry of Information, gate number 1. And I'm like, yes. This is it. I remember I drove back home, okay? Went to my room, and the funny thing is, I already had demos. I'm like, I'm making a new one.
Because this occasion deserves a new demo.
I even created jingles, 96.5 FM, and I changed my voice. I created that demo, and I remember I made it. I think I was the last applicant because it was the last day to apply. Funny thing is, even I couldn't even make it because the company I was working for, I had to drive to Riyadh for some meeting. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm going to miss the deadline. So I called a friend of mine. I'm like, bro, I need you to drop this at the gate of the Ministry of Information. And he's like, yeah, sure. Team Imran, okay? Because he was there when I needed him. He played a role in something that, you know, built my future.
Yeah.
And see how I didn't look at it that way back then, right, but I look at it this way now. So I remember I was still in college. I was in AMA, okay? And I got a call. And I didn't recognize the number. And at that time, the supervisor was a gentleman called Mohammed Romehi. And bless him. He was the one who trained me and taught me a lot of, you know, pretty much everything I know. And I recognize his voice. And I'm like, hello. And he's like, hello, I'm Ron Aradi. And I'm like, yes. He's like, this is Mohammed Romehi from Radio Bahrain. And I almost dropped the phone. I'm like, yes, Mr. Romeo. Yes, it's hi, hello. And he's like, you have an interview tomorrow at 5 p.m. And I just couldn't believe it. Do you know who was standing next to me when that happened?
Uh-huh.
Do you know DJ Outlaw? DJ Outlaw was with me in AMA. And I remember I was with him when I got that call.
No way.
I hung up and looked at him and I said, his name is Mohammed Qulum. No one, everybody knows him as DJ Outlaw, but his name is Mohammed. I'm like, Mohammed. He's like, what? I'm like, I just got a call from Radio Bahrain. I got an interview. And he's like, oh, no way. I'm like, yeah. So went to the interview and it was a tough one because they grilled me with questions. And I mean, I think I answered them naturally. I never got to ask them for feedback. There were questions like, if we put you on the morning show, what are we going to play? What are you going to play? What are the artists you like? And, you know, being like, I was a metalhead, okay? I would listen to, I mean, growing up, I was listening to Megadeth, Metallica, all these heavy bands, Rage Against the Machine, oh my God, Machine Head, oh my God, you name it. I used to listen to these crazy bands. But when I went to the interview, I made it very clear. I said, this is what I like, but I would like to
I'm
know.
I'm going
to
play it to the audience.
I'd like to know what the public like, yeah. And I would play it at that. I got selected to train, and that to me was the biggest thing ever. And I remember DJ Damien, one of Radio Bahrain's best, was on air back then. And when we entered the studio, we were getting a tour. He saw me, and I remember I used to tell him, I'm like, I'm going to make it to the radio one day. And he saw me in the tour, and I looked at him, I'm like, told you. And
how serious.
Yeah, and just joining the radio, that changed my life because there was so much value than whatever got into our bank accounts. Mm. So much more value. I remember when I joined and when I had my first show, it was a Wednesday night, 6 p.m. December 2006. Mm. 6 p.m. was my first show where I went live. I even remember the first song I played. And I didn't even ask. I didn't even ask, oh, how much am I going to get paid? I was just grateful to be there.
Wow.
And
wow.
So what happened? I used to be a wedding DJ. I used to MC events. Mm-hmm. But then all of a sudden, I'm not only that guy who grabbed the mic and talked and I'm the guy on the radio, you know? So things started to change.
Yeah, and the dynamics are completely different.
Yeah, things
you talked
started
about reading the dance floor. All of a sudden, you're in this closed room and you're broadcasting across the country.
Look at the difference. Exactly.
Yeah.
So in 2006, you know, social media wasn't a thing. The only thing we had was Facebook and people were still exploring it. So we highly depended. We used to depend on phone calls and public feedback, you know, and there was no Spotify, there was no iTunes, you know, there's no YouTube. So we were a very legit good source of music. The good news is we still are. It's just that we have a lot of competition.
Yeah,
we didn't have that competition back then. So this was 2006. Comes 2008. I've already built a little, somewhat of a name on the radio. The first year, I did Friday, Saturday mornings. So when everybody was just asleep, I'm there on the radio going, hey, thank you for tuning in. This is Radio Bahrain 96.5 FM. Nice, a cool Friday morning. It's 6:15 a.m. Give us a call if you're tuned in. One guy called. And he was working the night shift. Friday morning, I used to have all those party animals from Thursday night. And there was this one group that used to call me every Friday morning because I'm Muslim, Barmajin, and they were like my friends. They were like, I wish I would run into them now. I don't know who they are. I don't know what they look like. And they used to call me and I'm like, what are you guys doing? And they're like, yeah, we were just out partying. And, you know, at 6 a.m. we're grabbing breakfast and we heard you on the radio and we just called to say hello. Imagine. So it was, even though it was Friday, Saturday morning, it was such an amazing experience. And
that's so cool.
So when I told people that I'm doing radio shows, they're like, really? When? I'm like, Friday morning. And they're like, I'm not listening to you Friday morning. But then I started to do the evening shows, the weekday shows and stuff like this, a few weekend shows and you know, like a late night, Friday night show. So yeah, and then 2008, one of the local promoters approached me at the gym. He's like, hey man, do you know the Axis of Evil comedy tour? And I'm like, yeah, I do. I've got the DVD, which is true. I bought the DVD. And he's like, yeah, I'm bringing them to Bahrain. I'm like, no way. And he's like, yeah, I want a local host. Are you interested? I'm like, sure. He's like, but you got to be funny. And I'm like, I got to be funny on purpose? He's like, yeah. I'm like, I don't know. But yeah, sure. Let's figure it out. So we did auditions. There were a few other locals who were, you know, trying for it as well. My audition was terrible. They asked me, they're like, so, you know, can you share your material? I'm like, I have no idea what I'm going to say. And then they're like, okay, tell you what. If you feel like what you're saying is not funny, just play the role of an MC. Just, you know, welcome the crowd, talk to them, warm them up a little, and then just introduce the next comedian. Mm-hmm. I said, yeah, okay, cool, I'll do that. And I... At that night, I remember it was October 2008, 2,000 people in the audience, and we got to meet Maz Jabrani and Ahmed, and we were so excited, and it was an Ahli Club sports hall, mm-hmm. so we were not located behind the stage, we were opposite the stage, so when I had to walk to the stage to start the show, I walked through the audience. Oof. So I remember those 30 seconds while I'm walking through the audience. Keep in mind, the entire hall is full. It's the first time this is happening in Bahrain.
And you're literally feeling the size of the crowd.
And I can actually see them looking at me like, what is this guy doing? And I was like, oh my God, I have to be funny on purpose.
And not only that, people are there expecting you to make them laugh.
Yeah, it's a comedy show. So I had this small moment of panic.
I can't imagine something more nerve-wracking.
I've had worse. But I've had, maybe using the word worse is not the correct word, but I've had other moments where we're very, very challenging on stage and... You know, we'll touch on that. I've got a lot to share. So I got on stage and all I said was, guys, can you believe it? Axis of Evil is here. And this just all started cheering. And what I said, basically the first laugh I got was not meant to be a joke. I said, so I got selected. And this is what I said. It was not a joke. And I said, you know, so I got selected to host this evening. And I'm honored, and, you know, a big shout out to the organizers. Thank you so much. You know, I really thought that they selected me because I'm special, but apparently they selected me because I'm half Bahraini. And then they all cracked up because the way I said it, I was like, I'm half Bahraini. And then I'm like, and I'm half Pakistani. And they just burst burst out laughing. The minute I said I'm half Pakistani. Now, that was not supposed to be a joke. There's nothing funny about being half Bahraini, half Pakistani. You know? But to them, that was comedy. And I actually asked a few people after that, when I found out they were in the audience, I said, why did you guys laugh?
Yeah.
And they said, number one, unexpected. And number two, they're like, you had that look on your face that just cracked us up, as if you were disappointed that you were half Pakistani.
Son, the way you deliver it.
Yeah, and I remember that's when I got my first laugh. And I remember going back to the videos. You can see that look on my face where I'm a little surprised that they found that funny. When I got my first laugh, I just started to improvise.
Wow.
All right. Some of my best jokes came out that night, just improvised. And keep in mind, it came from somewhere. I grew up watching Richard Pryor, Eddie Murphy. Eddie Murphy is the reason why I wanted to get into comedy. I grew up watching George Carlin. Not supposed to be watching George Carlin as a kid, but, you know. And as a child, I mean, I'll tell you how I got my hands on Eddie Murphy's comedy show. You are what, 27?
27.
Do you remember ICQ?
No, what's ICQ?
No. I feel so old. ICQ was a software we used in the late 90s to chat.
Okay.
So I'm sure you know
MSN Messenger.
It was around the same time.
Okay.
So ICQ was a very big deal. And everybody, you know, you had your own unique number, you had your ICQ nickname. And then ICQ started to evolve where you could share files. And, you know, we'd go home, at night, we would log on to our ridiculously slow computers and our dial-up internet connection. A friend of mine sent me an MP3 on ICQ, which took 4 days to download, if not more.
I remember that
MP3 was the audio of Eddie Murphy's Delirious. His comedy special from 1981.
Wow.
Now that I'm thinking about it, why did you have the audio only? Like what?
Team Amrad.
Yeah.
It's Team Amrad.
Yeah. So he sent me the audio. He's like, listen, man, I think you're going to enjoy this. So I'm listening to it. And keep in mind, I cannot see Eddie Murphy.
Yeah.
I am visualizing it. I am listening to him. And I memorized the entire set. I knew all his jokes by heart. And I used to deliver them to friends in college. But I would say it. I'm like, guys, this is not me. I just heard this. Have you guys seen Eddie Murphy, Delirious? And this was late 90s, early 2000s. You know, we're still getting out of the VHS phase, entering the DVD phase. And it wasn't available. We knew only what was available to us through TV. And then when we got a dial-up connection, we were the cool kids. You know, and so that came from somewhere, the timing, talking to the audience, improvising.
Right.
And I was supposed to do like a minute between each act. At one point, I lost control. Which is now, because I'm experienced, that was a wrong thing to do. That's what an inexperienced MC would do, would enjoy himself a bit too much between acts. And then your job, or the job of an MC of a comedy show, is to carry the event and maintain the energy until the headlining act shows up. And so, for example, if I know the next comic coming after me is one, he's really chill, he's not crazy and running around, I gotta deliver my jokes in that 3 minutes before him.
And try to set that tone.
And just bring the energy down a little. So when he gets on stage, the audience don't feel that drop in energy.
Yeah.
Audience are not going to feel it. I mean, they're not going to know what I'm doing.
Or not consciously.
Consciously they will not be able to figure out. Because when you have someone on stage running around and then he's loud and then he's shouting, and then someone else comes back or someone else gets on stage after him and he's like, so Horace walks into a bar.
Both Horace
and then the barman said, why the long face? So You're going to feel that drop in energy. So the MC kind of carries the show. So I learned all of this through experience, through working with some. I mean, alhamdulillah, I'm blessed. I worked with some amazing comedians. I got to experience what Russell Peters does backstage. Wow. And this was not even in Bahrain. This was in Jordan. Wow. It was in Amman, you know. And I remember seeing Russell standing by the side of the... basically he was observing and watching the audience before he went on stage. And I'm like, well, so what are you doing? You know? And he's like, I want to know who the audience are. I want to see what demographic they are, how old they look. You know, are they teenagers? Is there anyone there who looks above 60? And then I'm like, oh wow, he's reading the room like how I used to do as a wedding DJ.
Wow.
You know? And again, that was my first year doing comedy. So I was very, very new. I did not realize how much I have to learn. And so, yeah, so after that, I'm like, you know what? I want to pursue this comedy thing. Mm-hmm. Everybody thought I was crazy until I started traveling. I started performing in Kuwait, Dubai, Abu Dhabi, Oman, Saudi. I've done so many shows, and some of my best shows are in Saudi. I did shows in India.
Wow.
Yeah, I did shows in India. I was all over the place.
Wow.
And the next thing you know, that kind of like it stuck there. But radio always stayed there. No matter where I traveled to, what I did, radio was always there. I mean, I performed in Jeddah. At that time, they were called the Jeddah Comedy Club. And it was a lot of fun. I've done some terrible shows abroad as well. The worst are corporate shows.
What are corporate shows?
Corporate shows is when a corporate is having a staff gathering and somebody thinks it's a good idea to get a comedian.
Doesn't sound like a good idea.
It is not a good idea. It's exactly like inviting vegans to a barbecue. You can't. You invite vegans to a barbecue. It's just not going to work. And, you know, sorry, my phone is not... I just want to put it... Just making sure there are no family or urgent calls.
So,
corporate shows are terrible. So, if I paint the scene for you, this is what it is. Staff party. They are there because their company asked them to. Yeah. We don't know who they are. They might like or not like comedy. They might not even speak English, or, you know, if assuming I'm performing in English. Sometimes they show up with kids because it's a family event. And... I've had the experience where I'm on stage and nobody's laughing because it's just not their thing. I did a show in Kuwait. It was a corporate gig. The upside of corporate gigs, they pay well. The downside is it can be terrible for your brand because you're on stage and nobody's laughing. So I did the show in Kuwait and the majority of the audience members were Egyptian.
Okay.
Now keep in mind, I can't speak that dialect to save my life. And there was one Kuwaiti guy in the audience. And they were all construction workers because it was one of the paint brands. And they had invited all the construction companies that purchased their paints. So they did this event for them. And then they're like, let's get a comedian. Yay. And they flew me down to Kuwait.
Sounds like an
and I even told the organizer, who was an employee of that company, and I said, are you sure you want to do this? Are you sure you want to fly me down there, business class, put me in a hotel, feed me, and then watch me die on stage? And he's like, no, my friend, no, it'd be very funny. And I'm like, okay, sure. Man, I'm telling you, I got on stage. Nobody was laughing. Nobody. And nobody was getting my jokes. And the organizer was getting annoyed. And this is despite my warnings. And then I'm like, you know what? I'm going to do some crowd work. And there's this one Kuwaiti guy. I'm like, oh, are you Kuwaiti? And then he stands up, looks at me and says, yes. And leaves the room. Just walks out. So when he walks out, any situation, anywhere in the world, that would be funny. Where the one guy the comedian spoke to stood up and walked out. But instead of people finding it funny, they just awkwardly stared at him, then stared at me, stared at him, then stared at me.
Oh my God.
And then matters got worse. So I told the organizer, if it's starting to die, I'm going to play this game with the audience where I get them on stage to kind of get their interaction going. So I need gifts. And he gave me like the worst pens in the world. So I'm like, sure, better than nothing. So I got this guy up on stage and I said, where are you from? He said, Egypt. And I said, what's your name? He said, Mina. And I told him, I said, you know, I have an auntie called Mina, which is true.
Okay.
You know, in India, it's a female name. And he did not find that funny. In fact, he got offended. The only person in the audience who laughed was this Indian guy. So, and I think, and from what I remember, he laughed out loud. And when he realized nobody laughed around him,
stopped crying.
His laugh just stopped mid-laugh. He was like, you know? And what I said was, oh, what's your name? He's like, Mina. I'm like, oh, my auntie's Mina. I'm like, do me a favor, don't go to India. And he just did not like that. So that show was terrible. And then I found out that they also got a comedian for day two. So I found him on Facebook and I said, bro,
we need to talk.
You're walking into this trap. If you care, don't do it. If you don't care, if you're just going to show up, get your paycheck and leave, by all means. So I've had several experiences like that. But now at this stage, and I'm 40 in a few days, when I get a request to do a corporate gig as a comedian, I just politely refuse. Or what I do is I make a suggestion. I'm like, I'll show up as an MC and I'll host the evening for you with funny activities. I'll entertain your audience, but not through stand-up comedy. Because what if they, you know, I did the show in Riyadh, in Saudi. What they forgot to tell me is that the audience were South Indian factory workers. They told me their preferred language is English. When I got there, nobody was laughing. And
they didn't understand.
They spoke a little English, but then, you know, when you speak a language, when you don't speak a language very well, it's difficult to understand the humor.
Right, right. You need to have a really strong grasp to get the nuances.
So I actually got off stage. I walked up to the first guy in the audience and I asked him in his language, because I speak Hindi, right?
This is during the show.
During the show. And I said, do you guys speak English? And I actually went up to him and said, tum logo Hindi malum, tum logo Angrezi malum? And he's like, thoda thoda, which means
a little bit.
Yeah. And then I said, tum log kahan ke ho? Like, oh, I'm sorry, Hindustani, which means like, oh, we're all from India. I'm like, we're from India. And they're like, one guy's like, oh, I'm South Indian. And I'm like, oh, okay. And I'm like, these guys have no idea what I'm saying. So I switched to Hindi. And what I started doing is I started making fun of the management's table. We're a bunch of English guys.
I understand. What's
yeah.
going on?
So now the management that hired me stopped understanding me, but then their staff started to enjoy it. And so I've had so many different experiences.
So many questions came up as
you were talking. By all means, keep.
What one thing I'm really curious about is what does the creative process behind coming up
with
your,
a joke?
Yeah,
or writing a joke,
or writing your content. How do you go about that?
Well, first of all, you have to identify your sources that inspire you to write. Mm. Every comedian is different. For me, it's family, it's friends. It's you can turn anything into a joke if you deliver it the right way. Experiences in general. I'm now, because it's, you know, during COVID times, we're not doing comedy shows. So all I'm doing is writing. And I wrote this joke about my luck with delivery guys. Mm. And of course, I have to make it funny. Because the experience I had is, despite my address being in the app, delivery guy will call me and say, send me your location. I said, sure. I send the location. He replies to my location's message and says, please share your location. I'm like, I just did. And
It's a struggle.
And I remember that specific day, I had three deliveries from three different companies in the same day. And every delivery was a difficult experience. One guy showed up a day early. One guy just couldn't find the house. Oof. You know, it just... So I'm like, I'm going to turn this into a joke. Yeah,
it's interesting because it's... You know? When I feel like people are laughing with you, it's almost like relief. Like,
oh, yeah.
Oh, you know the struggle.
Yeah.
You know, you're touching on these... You're bringing out, I think, these truths.
I mean, you gotta write material that's relatable. Mm. So I had... So I'll get back to the structure of, you know, writing a joke. In 2016 was a very memorable year for me. That year was a roller coaster. Ups and downs. Like, it was crazy. But one of the most memorable moments was my first comedy special was announced. Now, keep in mind, comedy specials, you'll see comics from the UK, US, Canada. They do that stuff. Mm. In the Middle East and Bahrain, shabidi, you know? Hey. But response was amazing. We announced tickets on Sunday morning. Tuesday afternoon, we were sold out. 700 tickets.
Wow.
Okay.
Was this the one in Gulf Hotel?
This was at the Cultural Hall.
At the Cultural Hall, okay.
Okay. The show is called Chicken Nuggets.
Okay.
Okay. Nice. And I, because the... Tartib. So Tartib and I became friends because I had my own agency at a time of my life where life was really busy. And you know Khalid Janahi?
Mm-hmm.
So Khalid Janahi and I teamed up. We were the first two to offer social media as a paid service. And then Tartib was also in the scene. And they started doing the same thing as well. And we became friends because when we started getting requests of talents I managed and talents they managed, I said, there's no point in competing. This market's too small.
Yeah.
Why don't we share the cake? Why don't we support each other? So when they needed Khalid Janahi, I said, go ahead. Mm-hmm. You treat him as if he's under you guys. And, let's cooperate. There's no, you know, and plus they were too big to compete with. You know, I didn't want to clash. It didn't make sense to me. So Tartib told me, they're like, listen, man, we've been getting requests of people asking us if you're ever going to put a show on. So they said, we'll do it for you. We'll sort out the hall, the marketing, the sound, the lights, everything. You just show up, be funny. At that time, it was 2016, and I started doing comedy in 2008, and I had experience all around the Gulf, you know, including India. So at that point, I had material that was tested.
Right.
Because one thing about comedy, you don't just write and go on stage and deliver the best joke in the world.
Yeah, I was going to ask, because you need to refine. There's this process.
You need to refine the
trial
joke.
Trial and error,
because sometimes, and not sometimes, it happens a lot. A joke in my head would sound hilarious,
right,
but when I deliver it, nobody will laugh. It
doesn't come out right.
And then the opposite happens. So basically, a comedian needs stage time. A comedian needs the opportunity to get on stage and test material and then pay attention to what works and what doesn't. So I was doing that for years around the Gulf, including India. India was an amazing experience. I'm going to tell you about that in a bit. So I had this solid 1 hour of material that I've used in Saudi and Kuwait and Oman and everywhere.
It's been through all the obstacles.
And then I realized I use that material everywhere but Bahrain. So I put all those jokes in one specific order, got on stage, and I dropped all of that. And it was one of the best moments of my life.
Wow.
You know, 700 people showed up, and tickets sold out in 3 days.
Wow.
I couldn't believe it. I remember the tickets were being sold at, well, back then it was called Viva. And I passed by to see what's happening, and I saw a queue of people buying tickets. And then I realized a lot of people are like, yeah, you know, we see you performing in all these other countries, but now you're performing here, so we want to buy tickets and come have a look. And so the point of, or the concept of testing material is very important, but how you write a joke. Now, of course, you can be creative as a poet, you can be creative as a lyricist, you can be creative as any person who writes, even an author, you know, has room to be as creative as possible. Stand-up comedians, definitely. But I'll share, I think you'll find this interesting, I'll share the format or what I, or my experience with format of writing a joke. So you have the introduction,
okay,
where you set an expectation. Then you have the body of the joke, okay? And then at the end, you have the element of surprise. Okay, so I'll repeat that one more time. You set an expectation, then there is the body, and then element of surprise. So I have three phases there. So when I start the joke, okay, there's one of the jokes I wrote, and this is one of the jokes I delivered at the Chicken Nuggets show, and it was the first time I delivered it in Bahrain. So I talked about being bullied in school. Mm-hmm. Okay, and I said, yeah, when I was bullied in school, it was terrible. And I dropped this joke in between where, because, you know, when you're different kids, this is true, by the way, kids don't really understand it. So they will just start making fun of it, or they will just get mad at you and beat you up. We're kids, you know? Yeah. So I used to go through this thing in grade 1 and 2 where kids would come up to me and say, I'm wrong, go rubiya. And I'd say rubiya. And then they'd reply back, umakindiya, ha ha ha. And as a kid, I just thought it was the dumbest thing in the world. But it turned into one of my jokes, and I delivered that. So I was setting an expectation. And then I said, so that's the body, right? And then I said, you know, there was this one time I was on the floor. This kid was sitting on my chest and punching me. And then I looked at her and I said, so you see what was there? I was setting that expectation.
Right. You already imagined.
See, that's the thing. It's a theater of the mind. So there's a kid on me. And he's punching me. So everyone's imagining a bigger kid just on me. And then I said, oh, I looked at her. And then I said, and then everybody just started laughing. That was the element of surprise, that he's been beaten up by a girl, which, by the way, is no joke. You've done it. I've done martial arts. I've had women kick my ass during sparring. It is a thing.
Absolutely.
So that was the element of surprise. There was another joke that I wrote. Another joke that I wrote for a friend of mine.
It's almost like a science, eh? When you
make it exactly. Down. It's the structuring of a joke. And there was a joke that I wrote for a friend of mine, and the joke was because he had this really small car that looked like a toy, and I said as a joke, play it on the projector or the screen at the back, show them your car, and then talk about the time someone tried to race you at the traffic light, and then you went for it, and you know, you lost. And then, of course, everyone is going to visualize some really hot supercar, know. And then I said, end the joke with, and just turn around as you say it, say, stupid bicycle, you know. So that was the element of surprise. So humor comes in many different formats. There's also something called a repetitive punchline.
Okay.
So if I say something, if I drop a punchline, and you find it funny, I will insert that exact same punchline somewhere else.
When it comes later in the
it could be any time. It could be even at the same joke, or it could be at the end of the set. So I did this thing.
It's
one joke I wrote, and this is my experience, because I had a lot of friends from the Indian school.
Yeah.
Like, I grew up with them. Indian school, Sacred Heart, you know, and they were all about the further studies. You know, it's that's what it was. And they all just kept studying. I'm like, guys, enough. We're 35. Stop. You've got 2 PhDs. So I wrote this whole joke, and I even delivered it in India. And they could relate. And I said, you guys are all about the further studies. And and then I'm like, you know, a friend of mine, you know, then I said, I'm like, can you imagine two aunties getting mad at their kids for not doing further studies? So the joke is that one auntie is telling the other auntie, I'm allowed to say that accent. I'm half Pakistani. So one of them is saying, my son, you know, he just finished his PhD. What is he going to do at home? Yeah. And then the other one replies, you know, he's 12. Give him a break, you know? But the way the joke is delivered is, you know, don't be harsh on the boy. He's only 12. Okay. So the word further studies was like a hook. And then at the end of my set, I have a joke about marriage. Okay. You just got married, didn't you?
Yeah.
So the joke was, and I involved the audience. I asked the men, I said, do you ever go through this where your wife is mad at you and you have no idea why? And then she starts crying. All the guys are like, yes, yes. Sometimes we don't know what we've done. And then the joke is that if your wife starts crying, cry with her, because that's just going to confuse her. And I'm like, that's just going to turn the tables. So I act it out. I act out the wife crying. And whenever he asks her what's wrong, she just keeps saying nothing. And then I said, and then I actually pick a couple from the audience and I say it. Next time she cries, I want you to cry with her. So then I act out the crying. So the guy says, I want to leave this house. She's like, so where are you going to go? Further studies. So you can interconnect two jokes using the same punchline.
That's fascinating.
And to me, that is the mother of, wow, you know, setting an expectation and then, you know, providing the element of surprise.
Wow.
I, by the way, I learned all of this through experience and I was blessed. I met some professional comedians and I went up to them and I would ask, do you know Omid Jalili? Look him up.
Okay.
Omid Jalili is a Persian British comic.
Okay.
And you might recognize him from the movie Scorpion King.
Okay.
And I had the pleasure of being the host for his show here.
Amazing.
And I had this whole joke in Persian because, you know, I grew up with Persians. So I delivered a joke about Persians. And then backstage, he's like, that was very creative. The joke was certain words in Persian sound like something completely different in English. You know, I'm not going to get into that now, but and then I asked him and I said, you know, any advice for a newcomer like me?
Yeah.
And he just sat me down and started telling me all these really cool things. And one of the things he said that really stuck with me is like, don't ever stop enjoying it, you know? And he's like, the minute you stop enjoying it, where it starts stressing you out.
It's like, yeah.
He's like, enjoy it, own the stage. And it didn't make a lot of sense to me then. And by the way, the best pieces of advice I got, I didn't understand when they told me. But it hit me when I opened for Moz here in Bahrain in 2014, and I wasn't an organizer. So the show was at 8. I showed up at 7:45, stress-free, walked in, did my 15 minutes, introduced Moz. The night was good. I enjoyed my evening. But I had shows where I was organizing, promoting, putting stuff together, and performing. I was miserable. And it affects your performance.
Right.
So I made a decision at one point to only focus on performing and staying away from organizing events. Because when you do both, it's not healthy.
That's fascinating. And I guess, like, just reflecting on what you're saying, I think you grew up very multicultural.
Oh, yeah.
Exposed to different languages, different people, different demographics, different nationalities. I feel like in your comedy, you use that to your strength.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that's probably one of what really sets you apart from anyone else. It makes you unique in the way you deliver your
comedy. Oh, yeah. I grew up around every single nationality you can imagine. They were around me as a kid.
Right, right. And by the, you probably, all of that, you just absorbed it.
Yeah. By the way, you know how
I... That's like your...
you know how I learned how to... Exactly. It is literally my tool set. When I started being familiar with different cultures, different people, different traditions, I remember like in high school, my best friend was Sudanese. And I used to spend a lot of time in his house. And I couldn't understand Sudanese to save my life. But then his mom started teaching me and his dad, his brothers, he started teaching me.
Wow.
And actually, I used it in one of my sets.
Wow.
And there was a Sudanese couple and I just switched to their dialect and they were like shocked. And then I started talking about, you know, the Sudanese accent in general. And like, for example, in Sudanese, like if you say shtebi, so it doesn't sound like Bahraini at all. It's very different than the Khaliji. If you were to compare, it could be as close to Saudi.
Interesting.
So because I had, you know, the pleasure of mixing with so many different, to me, different is good.
Right.
You know, a lot of people will see something different and would get uncomfortable. I love it. I love meeting people from different cultures and different backgrounds and different religions and different anything, because to you it just opens you up to something that you've never experienced before. I spent some time in Thailand, and I met this American guy who sold everything he owned in the States and travels between Thailand and India just doing yoga. And then he has a master in India that teaches him everything. And I'm like, what does he teach you? And he said, he teaches me physics. He teaches me biology. And I'm like, wait a minute. But what's the purpose? Mm-hmm. Like, what are you trying to be? But like, this is not an educational institution. This is an individual that is your mentor who's teaching you physics and biology and math. I don't get it. And he's like, you won't get it until you try. And I'm like, okay, I don't think I want to try, but enlighten me. Because, of course, I did, you know, for what he did was very brave. He left a life behind in the States. He was an IT guy. I met him in Thailand when I was training. I was training at a place called Tiger MMA. And he's like, it's the knowledge that I'm hungry for. He's like, the more knowledgeable I am, the better I am at life. Mm-hmm. And everything he owned was in a backpack. And he was so happy.
Wow.
Imagine. So when you're exposed to people like this, it gives you different perspectives and everything.
I can only imagine.
So, I met... 2016, I packed my bags. I went to Thailand for maybe 5-6 weeks. And I stayed in an area that was all about a healthy lifestyle. I was doing Muay Thai at this place called Tiger MMA, and then I was doing strength and conditioning at a place called Unit 27, and they were both 1 minute walks away from my hotel. And the place was all about
right there.
Exactly. And then the whole area, it's like a half a kilometer of martial arts clubs, gyms, restaurants with clean food, massage, physiotherapy clinics, tattoo parlors. That's it. That's what that area was about. And I spent a good couple of weeks over there.
Wow.
And I met people, like I met this American, another American guy who was Arab American. He was there for 6 months. And I said, wow, 6 months, that's a long vacation. And he's like, I was very unhealthy where I was back home. He's like, I would work 2 shifts a day. I would eat junk every day. And he's like, next thing you know, I'm morbidly obese and my life is in trouble. So he's like, now I'm here in Thailand and I train in the different clubs that are around. I'm on a meal plan and I'm just getting healthier and healthier. I've been here for 6 months. I'll probably be here for another 6 months. Imagine. So I met people who left their lives behind because they were losing their health.
Wow.
So all that job, that position, that, you know, that bank account didn't matter because they were in pain.
Right.
And in a way, I was kind of there for a similar reason. I was going through a tough time and I needed time out. And that was
away from everything.
Exactly. And that was the year I was training for Ironman. Mm. So the interesting part is I went from a ridiculous amount of stress and noise and overnight a flight to Thailand to complete peace and silence. I lost my mind. I didn't know how to handle it. Imagine, I got there on a weekend. It was a Saturday afternoon that I landed. And the area I went to on the weekend, it's dead. People leave that, whoever is staying there, they go to the center of the city on the weekends for life. Or you can just stay where you are. So I showed up on a weekend and I'm like, this place is dead, you know? But it was so quiet and peaceful. When I went to sleep, I remember I fell asleep at midnight. And keep in mind, I'm by myself at my phones. I have two Bahraini numbers. I deactivated or I pulled out the chips. I put Thai numbers in my phone. No one can call me. And I went from noise, stress, and drama to silence. I lost my mind. I didn't know how to handle it. I remember I went to bed at midnight. I woke up at 1 p.m. the next day, confused. So imagine, I went to bed at midnight. I woke up at 1 p.m. and I'm like, what? I've been out for 13 hours? And no sleeping pills, no supplements. I was just tired. And when I woke up, it felt so different because the air is different. You know, my phone's not ringing. I don't have these constant messages. I don't have people to run after and take care of. I was like, oh my God, I can go wherever I want. I can do whatever I want to do. I can't handle this. So I called a friend of mine, called her on FaceTime, and I'm like, I'm coming back in 2 weeks. I can't do this. Wow. And she's like, listen, Amran, just shut up. Start, do your thing, and just go with the flow. So woke up, you know, it was 1 p.m. I went, start walking around, looking for restaurants, had my lunch. And I started paying visits to all the martial arts clubs just to decide on what I want to do. 2 weeks in, I'm like, I can live here.
Wow.
So, yeah. I mean, one day I'll do that experience again when life and COVID lets us.
Yeah.
But, I highly recommend everyone and anyone to travel alone at least once in their lives.
Yeah, it adds, it's rather than, you know, just as much as it's about exploring a place, it's a lot about getting to know yourself.
It is all about getting to know yourself.
I can totally relate to that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, of course, it depends where you go. Mm. Like, I was in a very quiet area that was all about a healthy lifestyle. So I met people with a similar goal.
And you're around people that share that.
Honestly, it was like, there was this restaurant that I used to socialize at every evening at around 7 p.m. or 8 p.m. because that's when we're done with training. Mm. I swear to God, it was like therapy because, like, I met someone who recently lost a loved one. I met someone who lost their health, who was trying to get back on track. I met someone who was, you know, recovering from their alcohol addiction. I met someone who was going through a divorce. And everybody was there to improve the quality of their life. So everybody had a story to share. And then I remember that year, that month, is where I got a lot of clarity with what I wanted to do. Well, this is a very personal story, but I'm going to go ahead and share this with you because, you know, it is, I mean, I feel like someone else could benefit from this. I was married once upon a time, mm-hmm. right? So I was going through a really rough time, you know, and at the same time I was hosting the morning show. So waking up at stupid o'clock every morning, hosting, entertaining the country. And then I had my own company. So I was genuinely exhausted and so stressed. So that's when I made that decision to just go away for a couple of weeks. So that restaurant I told you about where I used to socialize every evening. So I made good friends with the owner. And she was this lovely person that took care of all the people who showed up to that area. And I ordered my dinner. She was on the table with me. And we were just chatting random stuff. And then a friend of hers showed up. Again, never met her, didn't know who she was. But it's so chilled out there, it didn't matter. If a stranger came and sat with you, said, oh, can I sit here? We'd be like, yeah, sure. You know, oh, my name is Imran, what's yours? And then you just end up having an interesting conversation with a stranger. And then she sat down, and it wasn't awkward, funnily. And she ordered her food. And then our common friend, the owner, got busy. So it's just me and this random woman just chilling, you know, talking about where we're from and what we do. And then she... So all I do is just crack jokes, right? So she's laughing.
You're doing
and
a
then
thing.
Yeah, and we're talking. And then she just looks at me and says, can I ask you a question? I said, sure. She's like, why are you so sad? This is after I'm cracking jokes and making her and people around us laugh, because I knew the people around us.
Really?
And I said, excuse me, what? She's like, yeah, what? Are you okay? You seem very upset. And I said, how do you know that? All I've been doing is just making everybody here laugh. She's like, yeah, but she's like, I can see it in your face. She's like, I can tell you are going through something.
Wow.
So I'm like, I'm like, this cannot be. How did she figure that out? And I'm like, nah, you're just bluffing. And she's like, you wouldn't call me a bluffer if you knew, you know I'm right. And I said, okay, explain. She's like, you're doing a great job being a good host, even though this is not your place. She's like, you're making everybody smile, but it's not about you. You've made it about everyone else. And she's like, I can tell that there are moments in between where your face just drops. She's like, so you are heavily preoccupied. You are upset about something. So you know how sometimes it's just easier to open up to a stranger?
Yeah, definitely.
So I said, well, I am going through this, 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 and this. And she's like, okay. She's like, Imran, in the past 10 minutes, all you've told me is how you want to be a good son to your mother, how you want to be a good colleague to your employees, to your coworkers, how you want to be a good manager to your staff. She's like, I know that you want to be good to the people who are, you know, in your circle. But she's like, what do you want? And I got uncomfortable. I got so uncomfortable. I started repeating the same thing. And she started getting annoying. She started getting annoyed. I was the annoying one. Sorry, I was the annoying one. She started getting annoyed. She's like, Imran, listen to my question.
Yeah.
Not what do you want to be to others, what do you want for yourself? And I started beating around the bush again. I started getting uncomfortable. Now, the problem is that when I started getting uncomfortable answering a question that's supposed to be so simple, that is a problem. And it's a bigger problem than what it sounds like, because my discomfort came from a place where my success or what I want makes people in my circle uncomfortable. So someone is doing something wrong, whether it's me, whether it's the people in my circle. So somewhere there an equation has,
something's off. Yeah.
So she's like, okay, I'm going to change the question. I'm going to rephrase it, and let's try this one last time. You're sitting here by yourself. There's nobody around you. There's no one to answer to. You do not have those responsibilities. Now tell me what you want. And I said, I want to grow. And she said, then do it. And I just sat there in this moment of silence. Because she made me realize what my problem was. My problem was that my growth, what I wanted to achieve, compromised the values of the people who were closest to me. Okay?
Wow.
That's the moment I learned the difference and the importance of values. So, my number one value at that time was health. but to the person who wants something from you, who will expect you to drop everything around you and run to that request and forget about the clean eating, the gymming, the meditation.
Wanting to work like a machine.
Yeah. So there is a clash in values.
Right.
Okay. Now, keep in mind, it's not intentional.
Yeah,
it's not just evil. It's not someone trying to hurt you.
Yeah.
It's just a position that you end up being in. Okay? So when I said I wanted to grow and I got uncomfortable answering that question and she had to paint a different picture for me, that to me was ridiculous. I'm like, oh my God, why was it so difficult for me to figure that out? It's because I allowed my values to be devalued based on someone else's priority. Now, that doesn't mean forget about everyone. I don't care about the close people. No, that means you look for a balance. Mm. So biggest example is my mom, bless her. She's 73. She's 74. She just turned 74. She had a shoulder replacement 2 years ago. So, you know, her value now lies with health and mental health and, you know, in her well-being. So I have to support that value, just like that I got that value as well. I don't want to be forced to eat the chicken or the mutton biryani. You know, I want clean food.
Yeah.
I want some time where I can meditate. I want some time where I can, you know, at least go to the gym 3 to 4 times a week. Mm. I need some time where I can meal prep. So when you are aware of each other's values and at what priority list they are, you can work with each other. Mm. So when I used to wake up on a Friday morning at 4 a.m. to go cycling in Zalug, to the friend who preferred to party,
yeah,
and get annoyed at me or forced me to stay up late so I'm tired for my Friday morning run or my Friday morning cycling session, me and that person have different values. But the person who respects the value but doesn't have it will say, hey, listen, man, I'll catch you some other time. So he respected my value but doesn't necessarily have to follow it. That concept changed my life.
Wow.
So when you can sit down and say, my number one value is, because see, I believe growth is, the reason why I said I want to grow, because I believe growth is the most important thing for many reasons. Now, I'll give you an example. Fahed, I met you when you were what, 13?
Yeah.
You were in the kids class when I was teaching.
Yeah.
And then I've seen you kind of grow up and evolve into the young man you are now. Mm. What I see of you today is a better version of what I saw a couple of years ago. I've seen you take podium. I've seen you achieve in motorsports in different ways. I've seen you walk on a rope. I don't know how you do that circus stuff, but that tells me that you've got above average balance and strength. It's true. I look at your social media stories and I get anxiety because you're walking on a rope, balancing like a circus guy. And if you fall in the water. I don't know what's in that water. So I panic when I look at your stuff, you know? So that to me tells me that you're athletically way more superior than most people, than you were yesterday. So growth is important. And the way I like communicating that is, imagine, you know, person A, person B, both in the same entry-level job, same minimum wage. And then 20 years later, they meet. Mm. All right. What do you expect is the conversation going to be? So if one person plays victim and says, oh, life was, you know, clients don't pay or whatever, and I don't know what, but then the other person has went through the same challenges, but flourished, but has growth in all areas of his life.
Yeah.
And I remember, you know how I said sometimes it's easier to confide and talk to a stranger?
Yeah.
This person I know, now we're not close, and I think I caught her at a moment of weakness, and she's like, hey, listen, I'm really, really sad because the person I thought I'm going to marry is marrying someone else tonight. And it just happened. And I felt so bad. And I'm like, oh, I'm so sorry to hear that. Are you okay? And she's like, yeah, I'm a little down, but I think I'll make it. And I said, okay, focus on growth. She's like, what? I'm like, focus on growth. And she's like, sure, but like, what does that have to do with anything? And I said, okay, I want you to visualize this. I want you to visualize running into the same person who broke your heart 3 years from now. Would you want to be in the same job you're in now, same place you are now, still sad, or would you want to run into him having a better job, being healthier, having multiple sources of happiness, having a better house, better apartment, better everything? Which one would you like? And she's like, oh my God, you're right. She's like, I did visualize running into him 3 years from now, and I want to be boss when I see him. And I said, that is growth.
Beautiful.
You know, growth is very, very important, because when you stop growing, you're going the other way around.
Yeah.
You know, I struggle. I struggle with growth in all areas. But to me, as long as I don't stop, as long as I do my 1% every day, I'm happy.
That's beautiful. That's beautiful. Thank you so much for sharing that.
I really hope, you know, whoever gets to listen to this also, you know, benefits. And again, if I stress on anything, if your name is Muhammad, identify Team Muhammad. If your name is Abdullah, identify Team Abdullah. If you're a Sara, who is Team Sara? Who is Team Fahd? I know who Team Imran is, and I constantly look for two new team members. I will be team someone else as well. So I have a really close friend of mine called Khalid Khalifa, and he's living in Jeddah now. And to him, I'm Team Imran. To me, he's Team Imran. To him, I am Team Khalid. And we're constantly sharing information that helps us, you know, be more knowledgeable than we were yesterday. We're always doing that. We do this thing where we talk weekly over video call, and we have this book, or he has this book that has 52 skills, and every week is a different skill.
Wow.
And we explore that skill every week.
Cool.
So at the end of 2021, we're going to have 52 new skills that we've learned.
Wow.
And so what does that mean? So we both know that in December, me and him have completed 52 skills that's going to stay with us for the rest of our lives.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Imran, yeah. Thank you so much.
I don't know how long have we been talking. It's 9:30. Holy.
Sorry, I kept you for a while.
No, it was a pleasure to talk to you. Yeah, we've been doing this for what, 2 hours?
Yeah, we're creeping up on 2 hours. And
wow, that's a lot.
Appreciate how like sincere, authentic, open you are. Has got to know any got familiarize myself with deeper layers of any who you are.
If you look at me, I do look like an onion, like an oversized onion. So they are a lot of layers.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. And you know, pleasure is all mine. And I actually do want to know your story as well.
Sure, definitely.
I know, because you just, you know, you were 14 or 13 when I met you, and then you popped up on social media, and I wasn't even sure you're the same person. Because, you know,
I remember you.
Yeah, like, I'm like, are you Fahd? Like, that's you?
Are you the same guy?
Because there was that time period where you grew up, got taller, and you know, you took your athletic ability, mashallah, to a whole new level. And then you shaved your head. So I remember you with a full
my choice.
I know, but and I remember you with a full set of hair. You know, you were I visualized that. And I remember this child who used to show up, and I remember you used to come with your at that time your baby sister
Talia.
And I think she is a all grown now, which makes me feel very, very old.
She's a young
old.
Lady now.
She's a young lady. It's scary. You guys make me feel terribly old. That was easily... Yeah, that was... Wow, how long ago was that? That was early 2000s.
15 years ago?
More than 15 years ago. Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
So...
it's been a while.
It has been a while. So I think your story is also to be shared. I know your father is a huge fan of motorsports as well.
Yeah.
So please give him my regards. If he listens to the last two hours, he probably hear it himself.
Yeah, I'm sure he will.
Okay.
Thank you.
Alrighty, this brings another episode of The Head Goes Bananas to a close. Thank you so much for tuning in. You know the drill. If you like what you heard, give me a rating, share it with your friends, with your family, anyone who might benefit from this, and see you next time.